Hi, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. This week's podcast is something a little different. Every entrepreneur reaches a point in the evolution of their business when they are faced with the crucial decision of the next step on the growth path and how it will be funded. There's no right answer. They can sell the business, scale it, or in some cases, IPO the business. We recently held the first of our Next Step events in the fabulous surroundings of the old trading floor of the Irish Stock Exchange. My three panellists, Dermot Crowley, CEO of Dalata, Leo McKenna from Occuco, and Mark Little of Storyful and Kinzen fame, gave great insights into each route in front of an audience of business owners. This is what happened there. Hope you enjoy. First of all, I'd like to welcome you all to this magnificent surroundings. This is the old trading floor, for those of you who don't know. Dealing may have moved digitally, but believe you me, if the walls around here could speak, I think there'd be an awful lot of people in Dublin very worried about some of the deals that may have been done over the years. But probably, irrespectively, I'd say there's probably an awful lot of history to tell. I know a few people in the room. For those who don't know, my name is Aidan Donnelly. I'm head of equities for Davy Private Clients. Tonight we're doing this obviously in conjunction between Davy and your next, my colleagues in corporate finance and myself. And look, ultimately, I suppose where this has come from is I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm really fascinated and love meeting managements and getting the insights from managements, be it public companies or private companies. Most of my work is involved in the public side of it, internationally, in terms of you know, UK, European, US companies and the Irish companies as well. But I love getting to meet managements and getting those insights. And I think if any time I can kind of get a bit of an insight in or get some of the thought process that's going through that, it's really, really important. This is the shameless part of the promotion. I do run a podcast based on that. It's called the Everyday Business Podcast with Aidan Donnelly. You'll get it on all of your channels. I try to interview entrepreneurs and business people, and again, trying to get that one-on-one idea of the insights that come true to it. So it's on all your thing. Like, share, and subscribe if you get on, and please do follow. Constructive criticism only. I don't take any other type of criticism. So we'll do that. The format for this evening, and really the basis behind this evening, is that we're trying to give some insights into, you know, four company owners, and that really is what is the commonality of the audience in this room. You're all either business owners, entrepreneurs, company owners, and we're trying to really give an insight around the possible routes to monetize that investment or exit that investment. It might be selling it. It might be taking on external capital, be it equity capital or debt capital, and trying to really ramp the business up or scale it up, and then finally, it could well be that the exit is an IPO or a trade sale. And I think the idea of this panel is that we've basically got one example from each of those sell it, scale it, IPO it camps. I'm not really interested in the financials of all of these things, because I think every company is different, and every company is at different life stages when they make this choice of either selling or scaling or IPO. But I think it's those insights that we're going to get from people that have done it that really, I hope, we're going to help you as we go forward in that. Obviously, as I said, this is ourselves in Davy on the private client side of it, and on the corporate finance side of it, and also you're in Next. And really what we're trying to say to you is, look, we have the skill sets no matter what your exit mechanism or your funding mechanism is going to be, that we can come and help you. And then, you know, ultimately on the private client side of it, when you do exit and you have the wealth to manage, we'll definitely be there to help you as well. So that's the other shameless pitch done for the night. You'll all see on your seats that there's a card here with a QR code on it. We're getting very flashy now. We don't bother with roving mics, though the lads do have one if you need it. But what will ultimately happen is, if you have a question, just scan the QR code and email it. It'll automatically come here to me, and I'll be able to ask the guys. So don't worry about it. Whenever the question comes to your mind, just do it, and it'll come up here automatically, and I'll be able to see it, and we'll try to work the questions in on that basis. So, with that said, we'll get to tonight's guest. Now, I'm going to start from the very far, my very far left, and work across. And I do feel a little bit like if you remember back when you were doing the oral exams for your Leaving Cert, and you're going in, and you always knew that whoever you were going to be talking to always was better talking or better doing the job that you're doing, right? I now feel that. I'm having the sweats coming out all right.
I'm taking notes.
People will recognise the man on the far left as Mark Little, and he began his career in RTE as a radio reporter after studying economics and politics in Trinity College. He was appointed RTE's Washington correspondent and ended his tenure, obviously, anchoring prime time. But in 2009, Mark founded Storyful, the world's first social news agency, which verifies user-generated content for publishers, broadcasters and social media platforms. Storyful was acquired, or he sold it to News Corp in 2013. And then in 2017, he founded KinZen, a support system for trust and safety teams who protect online conversations. Again, he's managed to sell that. He sold it to Spotify in 2022. So the acquisition by Spotify, I think, further underscores Mark's commitment to the enhancing the digital ecosystem that operates globally. Almost seamlessly into, as they say on RTE, in a change to our published schedule. Our second guest is Leo McKenna. He stepped in very kindly at the last minute when Yolanda Cooper couldn't attend for personal reasons. But Leo McKenna is the CEO and founder of OcuCo. In the late 1980s, Leo began his career working in the image processing R&D department of Ricoco company in Tokyo. In 1990, he moved to Credit Suisse in Tokyo before returning to Ireland to compete in an MBA. During this course of study, he began developing software for the eye care industry, trading initially under McKenna Software, which grew to become the computer department, then ultimately OcuCo. Leo's leadership has propelled OcuCo into a thriving multinational with thousands of customers worldwide. And in 2023, private equity fund Accel KKR invested 60 million euro in the business for a minority stake to help fuel its global expansion. And then finally, on my left, a lot of people will know this man, Dermot Crowley. Dermot is the CEO of Dalata. It's the largest hotel operator in Ireland, and with a presence in the UK and continental Europe. He began his career in PwC, where he trained as a chartered accountant. I won't hold that against you. But he's continued his career in roles with Procter & Gamble, Forte Hotels, and Renault. And Dermot built a diverse foundation in finance operations and business development. He joined Drury's Doyle in 2000. As head of development, initiating a chapter focused on the strategic growth within the hospitality landscape, which culminated in joining Dalata in 2012. And since its successful flotation in 2014, he's played a pivotal role in expanding the Maldron and Clayton brands across Ireland and the UK. So, gents, you're very welcome, and thank you so much for joining me on this evening. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, I am intrigued, and I always think about this. I always like asking founders this. So it's kind of to Mark and Leo first. When did you consider yourselves entrepreneurs or businessmen, or do you still not consider yourselves entrepreneurs or businessmen? Either or, jump in.
Yeah, you're right that it takes a while, even after you've set up a business. It took me a while, but I think it was when I did my first acquisition. It was when I thought, yeah, this is entrepreneurship.
I've never considered myself an entrepreneur, and I probably still don't, even though I might say that. I think everyone comes to this life, if I can call it that, that sounds like the mafia, from different places. You know, people run family-owned businesses. You've been doing this for 30 years. I came in with a specific purpose, and the only way I could achieve that purpose was to become an entrepreneur. So I'm an entrepreneur, I think, by need, but not by choice. But I did find as I went through the process that I shared a very, very, very similar DNA with people, probably all the people in the room, which was a stupid level of ignorance of risk, a monomaniacal sense that, you know, if not me, who? If not now, when? And so I did notice that I had some things in common, but then also realized there were a class of entrepreneur I never wanted to be, many of whom are active in the tech industry. And I started to feel, and I started to meet people like my co-founder in KinZen, Anya Kerr, who taught me so much about how to be way better as an entrepreneur by not reading a lot of the books that many people read. So yeah, I've had a very complicated relationship, as you can probably tell.
Do you see entrepreneurship as an art, a science, or a philosophy?
maybe a practice, I would have thought. Certainly, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. It was definitely what I wanted to do. I don't know, is it a philosophy or art or science? But it's a practice. Like you're in the game of business every day and trying to create new business and new opportunities all of the time. And I think in a different way to, you know, when I had a job.
I think the word practice is really interesting for me because it actually resembles a lot, I think, of the practices we do for health, physically, mentally. So I realized when I was a journalist, I would go to war zones and I would know, I'd get up in the morning and know there was a fraction of a chance I would die that day. And my job was to get back to the hotel bar and tell hair-raising stories to my mates. And that was survival. Became an entrepreneur and I realized it's not survival, it's resilience. Getting up every day, getting a kick in the head and being okay with that for a long time. Also emotional intelligence. People talk about smarts, but actually the understanding of people, whether they're customers or their colleagues or their co-founders, and knowing why they think the way they do, I thought was something I found to be really deeply exciting. So while I didn't choose to be an entrepreneur, by finding the practice every day of doing something to connect with people became so exhilarating that I could actually feel it physically some days in the morning. I'd get up and want to jump out of bed and do the job again that day.
So. In terms of the three different, you know, routes that we talked about, you know, selling the business, scaling the business, IPOing it, in each of your cases, what was the motive behind that route in terms of choosing one over the other? You know, with the IPO.
Well, yeah, well, I suppose back in, I joined Dalata in 2012 and Pat McCann was the CEO, and like we could see all these hotels that were owned by receivers. We could see a real good opportunity that we could potentially buy hotels at really good value. And we spoke to private equity firms, we spoke to property firms, and we could see really we were going to get a really small share of it. We'd do all the work and get very little reward for it. So the guys in Davies, Brian and Anthony are here today, and another guy, Ronan Godfrey, they actually brought the idea to us, you know, have you thought of the IPO route? Because Green REIT had just gone at the time, I think Hibernia REIT had just floated as well. So when we looked at it, we said, well, geez, we can control the company. Not control, you've got institutional shareholders, but you can really shape the strategy of it. And that kind of suited myself and Pat. We wouldn't really have been well suited at the time to having a private equity owner of, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the business. So that really attracted the independence and the ability to really shape the strategy and the excitement then of growing. I mean, the excitement of growth is just, you know, seeing people come into the company, develop their careers. You know, we were just chatting earlier, it's not about just money. Like, when you see a hotel open, like we took over a hotel in Amsterdam, and when you look up and you see Clayton over the door, like, if that doesn't give you a bit of a thrill. So the IPO was attractive to us because we reckoned, ironically, you have more control in that situation than if you had one large shareholder.
Yeah, and you're slightly different in that. An awful lot, for a lot of people, in a way, the IPO is the end of the journey. You need the IPO to really start the journey, you know?
Yeah.
And you've gone on to raise, I think, further two sets of...
It was actually three, actually. I forgot.
I was trying to work out whether it was two or three. What was the motive at that time in terms of the follow-on from the IPO?
Well, we raised, I think it was 265 million the first time, and we started spending that on individual hotel assets. And then the Moore and Bewley group came up, and that was, I think it was 450 million we paid for that. So we raised debt, but we needed to get some equity as well. So we raised 55 million in February of 2015 to close that deal. And then our shareholders actually said, look, you know, there's still hotels there to be bought. So the following October, we raised another 165 million, I think it was, and put more debt onto that and bought more hotels. It was a hugely exciting time. The one I'd forgotten, funnily enough, was in September 2020 during COVID. we raised another 90 million, and that was really at that point. We'd committed to a hotel in Shoreditch, which is actually opening in the next 6-7 weeks. So we wanted to be able to continue that commitment. And also give ourselves an insurance policy, like literally, we thought COVID was bad. We thought it could last a while. We were right. It lasted a bit longer than we thought. So that was a different reason. But each time it was very handy or very helpful to be able to tap the market and get yourself over what was an incredibly challenging couple of years.
And did it get any easier as each one goes along?
Yeah, I mean, the first one was chaotic, but it was great fun. We were a really small team back then, like really small. There's myself and Sean McKeown, who's our company secretary now, and Pat. And like, I always think if one of us got sick, I just don't know how it was, because there was no plan B. But it was great, and it was even with the guys working in Davies and A&L Goodbody, the advisors. It was just, and it's something I'd never done before. And like as well, like in the marketing roadshow, like you go up to New York and Boston and London and Chicago, like if that doesn't excite you, right? That if you're on the 80th floor of a, I was even in New York on Tuesday, like that's great trip. You don't like to be able to do that. I think you should just enjoy the excitement of doing things like that. So the excitement of that flotation was something I'd always remember as a highlight of my career, to be honest with you.
And Leo, you've done both the debt raise and the equity raise to scale it. What, in terms of the motives for both and, the different routes that you chose instead of, going second time on debt and going for equity?
Well, a lot of times these choices kind of get made for you. like for the first 10 years of our business, nobody was really interested in investing in us. And then for the next couple of years, after we started making profits, everybody was interested in investing. And at that time, I actually made the choice, this is not a bad place to be. And I went and bought back all of our angel investors and decided to go it alone and try to grow the company to a more significant size so that when I did have to give up equity, I might not have to give up a majority. And so I made that call in 2005, we did 7 or 8 acquisitions, mostly through vendor notes and cash flow, watching it carefully and, bootstrapping. So it was 2013 when we started to take on debt, and that was really because we got permission to do so. The Irish government had very much put their foot on the necks of the banks and told them to do cash flow lend to software companies to open that up, and we were one of the first beneficiaries of that move. So that took us down that road for quite a while. Ultimately, the Irish, the supply of debt to software companies in Ireland was more of a trickle than the pool of capital I needed to realize Occico's ambitions. So we went to America and raised money from Wells Fargo, about €30 million euro facility from them in 2016. And that was, that was really enabled us to really scale the company over that period. So ultimately, the choice to go for equity in 2023 had a number of factors. Could I have kept going on debt? It was getting pretty tense up there. We were pretty highly leveraged. And it was also, Occico has an ambition to grow the company substantially more than we are now, to take a seat at the top table of the eye care industry. And we were at about 30 million in annual recurring revenues, and I didn't really feel that we necessarily had the, not really just the capital, but really the know-how to go that next stage to 100 million, which is what we think would be where we'd want to be to fulfill my ultimate ambition of doing an IPO, perhaps. So we went and looked for a partner. And I think we found a great partner in AXA KKR. So,
Mark, you're slightly different in terms of the motive to sell. Was it just that you wanted out, or did you see the company better placed in somebody else's hands?
So I have contradictory feelings on both of the companies. I suppose what I would say in comparison to Leo and Dermot, with the companies I have led have been ones that have spotted an emerging problem in a market that doesn't yet exist, and I seek to define the market in many ways. So I compare it to a surfer spotting a swell, getting up first, staying up, and going as far as you can. So there's an element of risk that is probably means that the companies I have founded, you know, naturally found that choice coming in the first 4 or 5 years. So on Storyful, ironically, I look back in the business plan today to see, could I get some clues? And the very back page, it says potential exits, that in 5 years' time, we would sell to either Bloomberg, Reuters, or News Corporation. And that we cited a deal for $25 million that looked similar to what might happen. Like, we sold at the beginning of year 5 to News Corporation for $22 million. So it looks like it was an absolute, I was going for it. But I have to be honest with you, I deeply regret selling Storyful.
Right.
Because I was naive, too naive to understand that I had felt this flywheel click. The business was starting to work. I remember it because Osama bin Laden, if you remember, was killed in this compound. And this small team in Dublin were directing the world's media to all of the content surrounding, even the geolocations of the compound and the make of the helicopter in the crashed. Tiny team was literally defining it. We were telling ABC News how to get to the compound. It was just stunning what we were doing. And meanwhile, we'd found this magic business model where we would find viral videos that were supporting the serious work of kids crying and animals doing funny things. And it was the perfect model. We'd find the video, license it. YouTube had an agreement with us to make it viral, and then we'd go to other corporations that would make it even more viral. So we were actually double dipping on the revenue. But I didn't have confidence in our ability to raise finance. And I kind of had a try at raising finance. And I did what a lot of people do. I started to look for my Series A, also looking potentially for someone who might be interested in acquisition. We had interest from YouTube and Yahoo, and finally I got the call saying, Rupert wants to invest. I said, that's very interesting. He said, well, he doesn't take minority shares. And I think the regret I have is that I committed to that without really thinking about it, and you go through that door and you can't come back. Mm-hmm. So looking back in it now, I was naive. I think the company could have gone further. Ironically, in the second one, I had bigger ambitions. The first one had essentially said, "This everyone can speak on social media, who do you listen to?" Second one said, can I give every individual power to control their own newsfeed? With the advent of new technology called transformers back in 2017, which had become LLMs, we thought there was a game changer that could be huge, could be potentially a $1 billion opportunity. But I'm more satisfied with the exit we got with Spotify, because we'd started out being Spotify for news and eventually sold to become news for Spotify. And I think in some ways there's a false choice sometimes between do you scale or sell. Mm. We scaled through selling. Company was 34 people when we sold. Anya, who now runs the division, is running a division of about 85 people. The company's just opened Spotify Ireland. We are doing work that would blow your mind in multiple languages and developing a groundbreaking technology. We scaled by going deep into a company that were interested in what we did. So I feel in retrospect, that was the perfect outcome. Mm-hmm. I would say there's a common denominator between both of them. The things I've learned for, I think, people thinking about what they have to get ready if they think about selling are, number one, founder alignment. Really important that with your co-founders, you have exactly the same expectations of what Nirvana success looks like. Investor expectations and board structure to make sure when people come on board, you know they have the money to come through on rounds that follow and not screw you up when you're raising from bigger venture funds. I think also knowing a good lawyer who will help you, in our case was Mason Hayes and Curran, to maintain a very clean, tight cap table. And that was the mistake we made on the first one, Storyful. We didn't really have the power at the end. We had relinquished that in many ways. Investors wanted to cash in.
And do you think the business in terms of Storyful now, because of the parent it ended up in, is suboptimal to where it could have been had you managed to hold on to it, even for another 3 years, 4 years?
No, I think I always learned a distinction between, one entrepreneur discoveries was between price and lifetime value. Mm. And so the price for Storyful, selling it to that particular company, I think we could have done better maybe a few years later. But the lifetime value of Storyful, which still exists, if you turn on your television, if you see any really catchy video, it'll have been licensed and verified by Storyful. Storyful's playing an incredible role right now in the conflict in Gaza. So the lifetime value of all the people that came through that talent academy, we now have people who are running, you know, departments at CNN, New York Times have won Pulitzer Prizes for the work they've done, people coming out of Storyful. So I'm very happy with the lifetime value, but the price and potentially the acquirer would have been different if I think we had a founder who had a couple of other people in the founding team not just me.
One of the things, Dermot, that I always talk about when you're talking about people and companies is the idea that if you want to ask somebody to act like an owner of a company, you need to make them an owner of a company. And one of the benefits of the IPO route is you have paper currency that you can tie, well, not tie, but you can reward staff in, you know. Do you think it is as positive an incentive staff-wise as many people make it out to be?
Yeah, it's funny. We were at a remuneration committee meeting this morning at 7:30 talking about that. It certainly does at the, like, we in our LTIP, we have about 100, 110 people in it at the moment. And when that pays out, or when people realise it's going to pay out, it's over a 3-year period. It does have a huge impact on people, and it does keep people feel more connected with the performance of the company. Then when we try and move it out further, we've got a save as you earn scheme, but ironically it's more difficult to do that in Ireland at the moment, trying to work something out with AIB. But people do feel more invested when they do get shares in the company. But then I'll be honest with you, in hospitality, because we have a lot of transient, right, they've no interest. Mm. They genuinely don't have any interest. So I think when you're at the management level, even the management level in the hotel, a lot of people are very interested in it. But once you go below a certain level, you know, people...
It's those who see it as their career are the ones that are a lot more likely to...
And the other thing, because we talk about packages, and it is interesting, like the reality for a lot of people working for us, basic pay is really important because that determines their mortgage ability. So you can get kind of, you can imagine, oh, this looks great, but people have got bills to pay, and that's more immediate to them.
Leo, Mark raised an interesting point about knowing your investors and things like that. When it comes to that decision to who you're going to go with in terms of your scale-up, so you went with Axel, KKR, you need to choose your partners well. It's a bit like a marriage. Right? You know, you don't want to marry in haste and regret at leisure, you know. What were the things that, as you were going into it, that did you kind of have a checklist to say, listen, they've, you know, everybody brings money, but it's a question of what else do they bring?
Yeah, well, we certainly would have had about, you know, in the long list, about 100 companies that were spoken to by one of the team, reduced it down to about 25, which was a longer kind of conversation. They had all been selected to be interested in having a minority stake in a kind of B2B SaaS software company as well. So I suppose we did, yeah. I mean, we wanted to have fit in terms of the tech type of investor, in terms of, you know, the check size, the you know, we do B2B SaaS software, a bit of retail and a bit of healthcare would have been pretty nice as well. So the market, I suppose, that they were in was important. You're right about the money. Like I was skeptical. I'm skeptical that venture capitals or private or financial investors can provide much in the way of, you know, contact in the eye care industry. Like, who do they know that I don't know? or that their financial contacts are any better than I can get myself. But certainly AXA KKR really did seem to have invested in a very strong operating team. They call it the operating team, but this is the team that provides the expertise essentially from their portfolio to the company. And of all of the, God, it sounds like an advertisement for them now, but they really stood out from all of the others in the end. And that's why we chose them. We probably would have accepted, you know, 20% less than the best offer. Just for that. Yeah. They're really good. And it's 9 months now, so still in maybe the honeymoon period. But we have delivered our first bad news, and that's kind of, it's a little bit rough, but it's gone okay. Mm-hmm. All right, we're doing fine.
Divorce proceedings haven't been started or anything like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, no. So I think, well, they're stuck with me now anyway. Yeah, they can't have it.
And what about their role? Their role in the kind of the executive or the day-to-day decision making? Is it still Leo McKenna that the book stops in?
Yes. they're, well, as I find my feet with the relationship, that's, you know, they're very clear that they don't want to run the company, that they can't run the company, and they expect me to run the company. So me and the executive team. So they, certainly in terms of power and control, yes. However, they really do want to know what's going on. They have learned the business to a greater degree than I thought that a financial investor could. And they very much are contributing, you know, members of the management of the company that delivers the consensus that I act upon.
On the area of shareholders, Dermot, like the nature of being a public company is that you're kind of, there's a whole cohort of your shareholders that you'll never know and never meet. I may in a quarter, you know, rotate multiple different times. So, you know, how does that make managing the shareholders or the investor relations different in a public company versus the private one?
Yeah, so we would spend a lot of time on investor relations because I think it's like if you keep close to your larger investors, it just and there's not as many surprises, then that works much better. So we'd have a number of larger shareholders. I think the largest is a family company out of Saudi Arabia who bought in during the during COVID. We'd meet them once a year, have a Zoom call once a year, and then you've got people like Fidelity and Columbia, who are just large institutional shareholders, and they're very, the way they deal with it is, you know, it's very predictable. Mm. But then you can get individuals, you know, who come onto your share register, could buy 3 or 4%, and they're quite entrepreneurial, and then sometimes they don't fully understand, well, you're just 3%, mm. you know, and so that can be, there can be an education process there which can take a while. And then, as you say, we've some shareholders who got a 4 or 5%, never ever met them. So like it's an unusual, strange mix. And then you're always looking, you know, you look at sometimes you get an activist, we haven't had that, coming onto your shareholder register, and that raises a whole different set of challenges. So keeping an eye on your share register is something you keep pretty close mm. to, but they're all different types. And then you have a retail shareholder who could write a letter to saying, can I get a free stay in a hotel because I own 120 shares, whatever, and you'd be amazed some of the letters you get about opinions about some article you've done. And of course, you've got to treat all those with respect and reply to them.
Yeah, and tell them no is the simple answer. Yeah. On the scale side, Leo, you know, obviously, you know, you've taken the money on. You to a certain extent, you give up some control or the full ability to make the future of the company. But how important is it from the very get-go to manage the expectations of that new investor and that you're aligned and you're kind of going, yeah, right? They get where we're going. We're aligned, and ultimately, you know, the exit point that you're in agreement that you're not completely differentiated in terms of the exit agreement that you're going to get.
Well, I think it's very important. It's very important for them, and it's very important for me. And pretty much all of the conversations that we would have had, even at an early stage, would have talked about exit and the spectrum of possibilities that were, you know, acceptable to me and were acceptable to them. And it seems they're, so far, so good. They seem to be pretty well aligned with my expectations. Like, they'll certainly, I mean, I'd like to do an IPO. I guess that'd be my number one hope at some stage. But I'm also open to selling on to further private equity. I'm not keen on a trade sale, which potentially could have been a red flag for many. Not keen on a trade sale within the industry, anyway, a strategic sale, because I think that would kind of just constrain Occico's opportunity. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time talking about that, mm-hmm. and you know, it comes up every 6 months. But I have been lucky enough to meet a bunch of the other CEOs in the portfolio, and you know, what they say does seem to be bearing out. They have public companies, they have companies that have stayed for a long time, they've rolled into their other fund, their buyout fund, they have sold stakes to other private equity and all of those things.
Mark, you've done two sales now. Has the itch been scratched? You've started two businesses and sold two businesses. Has the itch been scratched, or?
With myself, Anya, and my wife have an agreement that we will hire a hitman if either of us try and start a new company from scratch. But to be honest, I'm already interested in a lot of what's happening. I think at the moment, this is one of the most interesting times of my lifetime in terms of the opportunities for businesses. But I do think, looking back on the lessons I've learned, I mean, I can't believe I was so naive when I started, you know, first of all. I also can't believe that there wasn't the solidarity in the startup community to kind of share some of the very hard lessons, which are sometimes embarrassing for people. You know, like, I'm embarrassed at the negotiations that, you know, took place initially with News Corp. I mean, we were going through due diligence that was almost killing us. I remember at one point they were sending us, you know, this book that thick, and one of the questions was, how many private aircraft do you own? You know, we couldn't change the light bulbs. We were that lean. And, you know, so that was ridiculous, because we realized also, I think, a little bit, when since then I've worked for a big corporation in Twitter. And part of what we were asked to do in these companies was spot startups that Twitter could acquire. And it's the corp dev department puts out the missive to everybody. What are you spotting? What are you looking at? And you can tell sometimes the corporations think a small company has magic beans. And when they look, you know, you know they're not looking for the right reasons. And I think it's a sniff test that every entrepreneur should have, because a lot of bigger companies, strategics, will kill you with kindness, will think they want you, but actually they don't know what they really want. And a lot of mistakes are made there, I think. Secondly is, a lot of these companies are just looking for the 10 slides they can bring back to corporate headquarters. Mm-hmm. And they really want to beat you or replace you. They don't come in peace. And then I think a lot of entrepreneurs fail to understand they're not going through an exit, they're going through an entrance. Because in a lot of cases, you'll want to stay on with the business and sometimes be required to stay on with the business. And what kind of relationship you will have in 2-3 years' time? Could you work with these people? What will be your position? Where's the growth opportunity for your team? And bringing that team with you is a big, big, big ask. So in so many ways, I wish we could sit down and say, if you're a company moving very fast, in a market that's very young, where the first 5 or 6 years there is a decent opportunity for you and you can boomerang from the sale into doing something impactful, if you're that kind of business, we should all sit down together and have a bit of a session to tell you what to watch out for. So things, for example, like, you don't necessarily need to sell. Sometimes you'll have a big partner, and this has happened in both my startups, where YouTube gave us an advance payment. They liked us so much on the advertising we were going to earn, you know, $600,000, which made such a difference to us, without an option to buy. And I think there's a lot of these kind of different options where maybe you might become dependent on 2 or 3 big partners, one of whom will acquire you potentially, is to test the waters and kick the tires. And there's ways you can do that through call options, if you have sufficient funds independently, through these kinds of bigger partnerships, and get to know the corp dev people in the room. Because very soon when you're selling to people, you'll see someone creep in and they're the corp dev people looking at you, sizing you up, and get to know who they are and what they talk.
And it is a very interesting thing, because oftentimes we always talk, you know, when the topic of M&A comes up and a company's been acquired and things like that, it's always, the view is always from the acquiring company side, say, how did you integrate this? And very few people think about what it's like being the target that has been acquired. And you know, how important, I suppose, then is the fate of the staff and their future when you're in that type of a sales process?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're looking at the team that we hired. I mean, again, with Anya, we very clearly wanted to hire people who are smarter than us. And I think sometimes big founder mistake is they want to be the smartest person in the room. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in trouble. Mm. So you're always hiring people that are challenging you. And then you know that in the end of the day, that team is your success. Like, your product may be flying, but, you know, at a Series A stage, maybe where you're just getting product market fit, it's all about the team. And if you're hiring well enough, as we've done, it's one of the superpowers we've had, those are people who are thinking, do I want to be a group product manager in a big corporation in the next 3 years, or don't? And you sit down and have this conversation at the very beginning. It's never too early to think through an acquisition, even if you never do it. Just getting ready for those conversations with the team. So we were, myself and Anya, absolutely honest about everything. Whereas in Storyful, we weren't. I remember once we were in conversations with News Corp and they sent Rebecca Brooks, who happened to be involved in the big hacking scandal, as you remember. And she walked in the door of the office, and I remember, you know, people looked up like stunned, because there was a certain amount of information that we were keeping to ourselves. So I think radical transparency with a team about all the options, with, you know, the plan A, to be IPO'd at some point in the future, plan B, potentially acquisition, and where's the lifeboat if we run out of money? Are we going to continue on? How can we do that? So Anya and myself had that plan A, B, and lifeboat conversation constantly. Finally, I would say pre-mortems for me are the way to go for a small startup at this delicate stage. What could go wrong? How could I fail? And sitting down and working that out is, for me, the biggest benefit of the second time around. And again, I think we're probably, as a community, not talking about this stuff enough. Partly because I think there are certain people who don't want us to know these things, you know.
There could be a good book in that, Mark. I'm just saying. Dermot, the other thing that always strikes me, once you go into the public company route, the value of the company is marked to market every day on the screen. Every day that I look at it and I see it, and it's very, very visible. Does that impact the way the business is run on a day-to-day basis, or alter the strategy of the company over the longer term?
Like, you'd like to say it doesn't at all, right? Okay, but like for us, I mean, it's, when you look at our share price at the moment, it's about a 40% discount to the value of the assets, right? So, and that's kind of typical for hotel companies or property companies at the moment. So unfortunately, what happens then is you have lots of conversations with shareholders as to, you know, why is the share price where it is? Well, I mean, the reason the share price is where it is because there's not enough, you know, people aren't buying it. That's because it's buying and selling. But your big issue then is that, you know, like we did a shareholder perception survey in the last 6 months. Like, some shareholders think we're overgeared. Some shareholders think we're undergeared. Some shareholders think we should do a share buyback. Others violently oppose it. Some think we should do more dividends. Others think we should do no dividends at all. So that is a challenge, right? Because if you've one owner, right, at least they know what they want. Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think what you need to do then is ignore that noise, right? Because ultimately you're paid to run the company, and your team is to run the company. So I think if you leave the share price and all those opinions distract you, you'll go down the wrong road. So what is really important is not to be looking at the share price every day, not to be, like when you do a day of investor relations, like I did earlier this week, your mind's frazzled at the end, and I realized, thank God I run hotels as opposed to, I mean, the financial markets, right? So I don't think it really does influence what we do, right? Because you need to be purposeful and say, what's the strategy? How am I going to fund it? How am I going to execute it?
And the share price will take care of itself.
Exactly, and if the shareholders don't like that, they'll sell the share, and there'll be someone else then who'll buy the share, and ultimately the sufficient market hypothesis you learned a long, long time ago, hopefully that'll take care of value. Mm.
Leo, the you know, when you go through that scale up process, and I know it's kind of early in your development so far in that new world, but does the culture of the company change, or is there a risk that the culture of Occuco is different in a year's time or 2 years' time because of the scale up, or can you keep the essence of Occuco that was pre scale up?
I think so. I mean, the culture of the company largely flows from the CEO. as long as, you don't do anything too stupid with acquisitions. So what I've found, we've done 18 acquisitions, and two of them were tricky, and we had cultural integration problems, and they did cause, I don't know, like a just a quirk in the culture. It didn't work for a while then after following those. So I find if you keep the acquisitions below 15% of sales, or each individual one, that tends to work. They roll into the culture quite well. And then, you know, as the CEO just has to be very present in these acquisition processes or major change occurrences. But I think the culture of Occuco will hold together.
Mark, the question from the audience here is, you know, the process of finding the two acquirers, did you find them? Did they find you? Did you reach out? What was that kind of, you know, marriage, you know, process that went on?
Well, because we were, you know, raising a Series A, and I think this is a very good way of always, if you are looking at that option, is to go and raise finance. And what happens, I think, in any business and strategic acquisition, there's corporations that have their own funds, first of all. There's also VC that have experience with certain big corporations scouting as well. So when you're going out looking for finance to support the company at its growth stage, you are also encountering people that may not want to take a minority stake, that want to take a majority stake. So first of all, I think that is a good way of doing it. It basically allows you to do all the requisite due diligence. It also, I think, requires you to have, I think we mentioned culture, but one of the things for people, I think the majority of CEOs starting out don't have the level of business expertise that we have here. They're learning as they're doing it, and I certainly did. I mean, I was so inexperienced my first day. I wrote my business plan on a whiteboard with a permanent marker. Like, I literally didn't have any experience. But learning, and people get intimidated by this, the language of corporate governance, of having a board structure that works, learning the intricacies of your balance sheet, understanding the terminology. When a VC comes and asks you about your, you know, your cost of acquisition in year three, you know, you kind of laugh at them the first time they ask you, I don't even know what the fucking revenue is going to be. But they're asking you to ask yourself questions and speak in a different language. And I found that one of the most satisfying parts was by fundraising, by understanding the cap table, by understanding the nature of different investors' demands of the company, that we were really fit in both in terms of Storyful and with Kinsen when the acquisition came around. So I would urge everybody to, you know, get ready for the both options. So go for the growth round of finance, or someone pops up and says, I want to buy you. We didn't seek it out. The one that got away was YouTube. Mm. And one of the things I realized is that when you become too dependent on certain partners, a management change, literally, in like will totally change everything. Mm-hmm. And you think you're about to get acquired by the company of your dreams, and someone just then goes off and joins Yahoo, and you're screwed. So, like, it is the delicacy. Like, Ray Nolan always tells a great story about, like, being on the verge of a huge deal, and the person's coming over to sign the deal and turn the plate around because the market conditions that day had just collapsed. So, you know, if you get too vested in potentially the acquisition from your dream acquirer, you understand that is so fragile. I feel their last acquisition with Kinsen, we were like Indiana Jones racing down, and we could see the big barrel coming after us. Because on that last day of that last quarter, after that, what happened with all the big tech companies was they started to retrench. We were literally, I think, 4 or 5 days away from losing that deal.
The last bit of ink that dried on that trend.
Yeah, but you want them to come to you. Yeah. Unless in some cases, and this is something people may have to think about as an acquihire, where you really have built something of value, but it's not going to be a successful business. And there's too many zombie companies walking around, giving away more equity and convertible loans. And the one point you say, I've got a great team, I've got something of value, and I may go then and talk and say, well, listen, this is not working as an independent business. But having yourself very fit as an organization and not investing everything in the CEO or the single founder, I think is important. But knowing when to make that transition, like a CEO for the first couple of years soaks up the anxiety for all the staff so they don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. But there's a point at which you have to then decentralize power a bit more. And I think a lot of young founders probably don't get prepared for that moment, which I think is then allows you to have a lot more options when suddenly your C-suite exists. There's a good board functioning as your advisors, not people you're going to excuse your lack of performance, but like you're literally seeking their help. So I think those are some of the things that are the common denominators in companies that may want to sell at the stage I did, or do what we've just heard, go on for the dream of the IPO. I think they all have the same common denominators.
Dermot, the pushback that people get when they talk about the IPO route is that there's the balance between listing, particularly it's very beneficial if you're going to see yourself requiring multiple tranches of funding, because once you're on the market, raising that money is very easy. But you kind of marry that against all of the extra regulatory compliance IR tasks that have to be carried out as a quoted company. Is it a good idea that people kind of think about that and have that, you know, the idea is that you're going to have to balance the good with the bad. Yes, there's an awful lot of extra work in terms of regulatory, but it makes it worth it if you are ultimately looking for, you know, a constant or a potentially constant access to liquidity.
Yeah, like I mean, I would say it's not just constant access to liquidity. It's also the fact that you do keep a fair, I know it sounds ironic, independence, I said earlier, right? So you do have more control of your destiny unless you get bought out, right? Okay. So yeah, there is a fair amount of regulatory, but, you know, Mark was saying there earlier, like if you get, you know, good advisors, they can really guide you through it. And I think people get really worried about it. You know, like I knew nothing about floating a company before we did it. But like realistically, they'll bring you through that process and they'll tell you what to expect. And you learn a lot from it. And then the key thing is make sure on your team you've someone who, you know, who's actually interested in that as well. Right, that's going to actually manage that regulatory side for you, because that's a completely different skill set. So again, like every form of funding is going to have some sort of disadvantage. But the big advantage of the IPO is that if you're like us, where, you know, we're completely free float, you do really keep control of the strategy, and you can actually build the company in the vision that you have for it and the team has for it. And I would say that's like one of the concerns I have in Ireland is that we just don't have enough floated companies. And you know, even I was in New York on Tuesday, and a US investor said to me, that is a disadvantage. He said their perception of Ireland is that people, they sell out. I don't mean sell out in a bad way, but they exit. And I think there isn't the same culture here of retail share ownership, because there's stamp duty on the way in, there's stamp duty on the way out, there's CGT. Whereas in the US, they're very focused on encouraging people to take the risk, and they encourage and make it easier for you to float. And then the market's just far more liquid than it would be here. And I think if we could focus more, I sound like I'm doing an ad here for Euronext, right? But there is a huge benefit in having a large, that there is an option in terms of the public markets, which I'd worry about, because the bigger companies, understandably, CRH and Flutter, understandably, as they get bigger, the US is hugely attractive to them. But what we need is a whole supply of younger companies
coming through.
It's really good for the economy as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have Leo now in a few years' time coming on board.
I'd advise you. A bit of luck.
The you know, this is to Leo and to Dermot. The idea of being a CEO in a company, right? I've often heard it said that, you know, you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you get quicker at making the really important decisions. Would you agree or disagree to it?
Look, like anything, the more experienced you are, the better you get at it. If you're, as long as you're open to learning, you definitely get more comfortable in it. I think the key thing, I think one of the guys said earlier in terms of setting the culture, the key thing I've learned over the last 3 years is how you communicate is critical. That actually people are listening to you far more because you're CEO. So when you speak, you just need to make sure you're on message. If I was saying that's the one single thing I've learned in the last 3 years. When you speak, make sure it's like you understand the message you're trying to get across, no matter what the audience, especially internally.
And that's to all your stakeholders.
All your stakeholders, but especially internally. Because what you say, right, no matter what the size of the company is, has a huge impact on the direction of the company. I learned that. I was only CEO about 2 or 3 months, went into one of our hotels and said, geez, you know what, maybe if we did this, this, and this, that. And they did. And it was only kind of a thought in my mind, right? And then one of my, Shane, one of the other directors said, Jesus, you just need to be careful what you say, right? So that was something I learned.
So you now have a corporate lawyer hanging around you every time you...
No, I'm just careful. I'm just careful what I say.
And what about you, Leo?
Well, I think, I mean, we must be learning something as we go through. Like you, I mean, I think the job has a lot of responsibilities with it, and I found as the years have gone on, my company has grown a lot. And so just like you mentioned with your story about, you know, you've got to be very careful about what you say. You've got to be more careful about different things at each, certainly I have had to be at each stage of my CEO journey as well. So I guess I must be learning something. And as that happened, and I have to, because the company's growing and changing all the time.
I'm conscious of time and I'm conscious I'm up against it. So I'm going to have one last question, and it's completely different from what we've discussed before. But I can't let Mark Little go without getting his views on where the US election is going. Nice short one. In a minute, under a minute, please, if you don't mind.
Just tell us everything's going to be okay.
Based on what we know today,
yeah.
Joe Biden will win more votes than Donald Trump and will lose the election in Georgia and Michigan. However, I do think there are certain things happening right now, generational differences in the United States, that may well see a surge over the next 8 months for Biden from younger people. But the fundamental thing to remember is America's broken. If Biden wins next time around, he will still have a Supreme Court that's loaded, not just against him, but like on a Christian nationalist belief. And I think over 5 or 10 years, America will heal itself with the next generation that emerges, which is much more radical, much more open. But in the next 5 to 10 years, America is broken and will get worse, no matter who wins the election next year. I'm sorry, I'm giving you now
a
very...
a bit of a downer to end things on.
I will leave you on a positive note.
Listen, I'd like to thank my panelists, Mark, Leo, and Dermot. I'd also like to thank you for coming, the audience and guests tonight. A special thanks. I have the easy job in all of this. I just come here and I sit and I just ask the questions and things like that. But trust me, there is a monumental amount of work that goes on in the background. So I have to give thanks to, on the Davy side of it, on the events team, to Ruth, to Emma, to Sue, to Keely, to Emmett, my colleagues and private clients, the guys in corporate finance, Derek, Jonathan and Barry, and also, of course, to our host here in Euronext, Adam, Niall and Helen. And also like to thank the HBV guys, who were always very good in terms of getting the sound quality very good for us. I'm going to plug the podcast once more time. Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. Like, share and subscribe. Please do. And look, I'll say good night and very much thanks for coming and have a safe home. Thank you.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.